And then that becomes the match. That news gets all the way to, that battle gets all the way to D.C.
Yeah, the president's mad. Winfield Scott's mad. Everybody's mad. Jefferson Davis is mad. Secretary of War at the time.
And Scott was
Secretary of the Army.
Secretary of the Army.
Yeah. And President Buchanan. And they ordered a swift and strong response. And so Wright was ordered by, this time it was General Clark, who had taken over Wolf's spot as commander out here. And he ordered him to put together a force and teach him a lesson. And Wright did that. So he assembled one force to go up the Yakima Valley under Garnett. And then Wright would lead the main force up from Walla Walla up into across the Scab Lands up to Spokane, mm-hmm. and then ultimately over to Coeur d'Alene to the mission at Cataldo.
Mm-hmm. And that was that tragic year, 1858.
This was 1858. So the Steptoe event was in May, mm-hmm. and then it took a few months to put things together, and then Wright set off in August of 1858.
And the Battle of Four Lakes was September 1st of that year, as I recall.
Yes.
And that's, it's a wonderful account in the book of how that unfolded, and it lets people visualize. It's almost like you can see part and much of the battle from Interstate 90.
Right there. Yeah.
Right there. Among other things, both the soldiers and the Native Americans learn about the power of the new rifles, how much farther they could shoot more accurately than either had actually experienced before, and that was part of why that battle was so lopsided.
The Battle of Four Lakes represented a real change in warfare for the Army in the West and anywhere for that matter, because they did have new long range rifles. They were in the right hands; they could be accurate to 1,000 yards. And the Indians had never seen anything like it. They had muskets that they had bought from the Hudson's Bay Company, which were not very effective. I mean, maybe up to 50 yards or so. It acted more like a shotgun than a rifle. And they had never seen anything like it, and it didn't take very long for them to figure out this wasn't going to be a good day. I mean, they knew as soon as they saw the soldiers hitting some of them from long distances that charging the soldiers was going to be futile. And that was their preferred way of battle, was to hit and run. Mm-hmm. They didn't form ranks and use the kind of discipline that the Army used.
Which, you know, the way Wright was trained would have been the preferred way to do battle with anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And in the French style, pick your battle.
He did.
And be very formal about it. But something else is going on at this time. I mean, and you do a lot of good scholarship on this. And this is my word, not yours. There is a menace, and there is a very purposeful menace in the way Wright came in to conduct that campaign. I mean, they were giving themselves, and he especially was giving himself permission to use, I'll refer to them as very draconian measures. I don't want to wrongly paraphrase you, but it seems to me that they come right up and at times over the line of what we would consider acts of war crimes. Mm-hmm. I know that's an explosive phrase in this context, and one that you, for reasons that you talked about earlier, deal with gingerly and with care, given the long lens of history. But describe the purpose of that. I mean, unquestionably, this was not police keeping. These soldiers were not there to police a truce or police a peace. They were there to send a message.
Yeah, they were there to subdue the tribes, and there was certainly an element of revenge in their actions, in the entire march, and in their actions. If we look at what they did day to day, after the Battle of Four Lakes, there wasn't an Army soldier who was so much as injured. It was just unbelievable.
Remarkable.
You have, yeah, there were involved, there were 500 or so soldiers involved in the action that day. And probably somewhere 800, maybe 1,000 Indians involved. And this battle went on for 3 or 4 hours. How can you not have somebody injured? There weren't. And so, and it was the long-range rifles kept the Indians out of range. Their bows and arrows were useless, and their muskets were useless. So, being out there on the walking the terrain, I just am amazed that a horse didn't step in a hole and break a leg and throw somebody and, you know, cause an injury that way. It was just, but no. So what happened at the end of that day was that George Wright wrote that Providence had guided them, and he very much felt that God was on his side. And that was a theme that returned as events unfolded, because on the 5th of September, there was another battle that in some ways was even more dangerous for the soldiers, and it's remarkable that none of them were killed. And again, Wright gave credit to Providence. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he ever used the word God, but frequently referred to Providence.
And the second battle took place
in Spokane Plains, which is present day the airport, Fairchild, up towards the Spokane River. And they ended up at the Spokane River up it's now part of Riverside State Park, where they camped.
Right.
Across from Fort George Wright.
And isn't it even by that time, by the time the camp is up by the river, that Wright is beginning to tell the tribes that and use the Battle of Four Lakes and the lack of casualties as a message to say, you know,
yeah,
you're being vanquished here, and I'm the one who's going to decide how this plays out. So
yeah, so he didn't, his communication with the Indians really picked up after that battle, and they started moving down the south bank of the Spokane River, mm-hmm, towards present day Spokane. And along the way, he had a few interactions with Spokanes, just saying, you know, we're gonna be going through here. Don't try anything. Warn people, you know. And they captured a fellow named Johout and a Palouse, who they accused of being involved in some nefarious activities, and they ended up hanging him. It was tactically a bad move for Wright to do that, because that scared off the tribes and made his efforts to make peace later that much more difficult. But at the time, he just wanted to send a message about who was in charge. And so the army moved along the south bank of the river, burning food supplies. They would take whatever food supplies they could carry, grains primarily, and stashes of berries and things. But they would burn whatever they couldn't carry, and they would burn houses, huts or whatever. And they continued that way all the way up the river to what is now near Liberty Lake, and they saw a big dust cloud and ended up capturing
the horses,
yeah, maybe 1,000 or so. There's all kinds of numbers out there. And they gathered them down along the river on the spot that is now a big truck way station on the freeway, 2 miles west of the Idaho border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all know exactly where that is.
Yeah, there's a monument there. Mm-hmm. And that location was where Wright really sent the message. They camped there for a few days, and at that location, Wright had communication with Father Josette up at the mission. There's this fellow named Sebastian, an Indian, who was a courier riding back and forth carrying messages. And Wright was telling Josette to call in the Coeur d'Alenes, tell them that if they come in, they're peaceful, I'll be there in a few days, we'll talk things over, they'll be fine. But in the meantime, he had some business to clean up. At the same time, from the horse slaughter camp, John Mullen wrote a long letter to, I believe it was to the Secretary of Indian Affairs, which was kind of an arrogant letter. Mullen was he wrote a lot and had a lot of opinions, and he was eager to express them. So he was giving advice to the Department of Indian Affairs about how to conduct business with the tribes, and in that letter he said that he realized that the time was limited for the Indians, and it was too bad that they were all going to be gone, you know. And this was a kind of a common thing that the men talked about, You know, they kind of like the Indians, and they're like, I understand, like Kip said, Lawrence Kip said, I understand why they are so upset. Geez, if I had all this, I'd want to live here, you know? It's, I just can't imagine. It's too bad. They felt bad for them. But, you know, they had a job to do. So they rested at that location. They killed the horses, about 800 of them. They kept some. They gave some to some of the loyal Indians, the scouts, the Nez Perce, the Packers, kind of divvied them up.
And I have to interject that your description of that scene is just heart-wrenching. Not only the slaughter, but the amphitheater effect where the Native Americans were forced to, were able to watch the slaughter.
Right.
And that seemed purposeful, that this is part of, this is part of communication. It wasn't just destroying the horses, which was, you know, bad enough given the, maybe bad is, probably wouldn't use the word bad. He would probably say it was good because it was shock and awe. This is part of what we, in modern terms, would be called shock and awe.
It was shock.
Break the will of your enemy to attain a peace.
Yes. And this is the point in the sequence of events where something changes with Wright, in my mind, mm-hmm. where that menace you mentioned earlier really comes out, because what he's saying changes in his letters, and in fact what some of the men say in their journals changes. It had been, we're worried, we're going to be in a fight, we don't know what's going on. You know, it's this like kind of an equal battle against an enemy force that you see in any kind of a military engagement. But once they had got to the point of killing the horses, everything changed, and they started talking about the terror. And George Wright wrote to his superior that I have used strict measures, something like, I have used strict measures, I'm teaching them a lesson they'll never forget. Mm-hmm. He didn't ever use the word terror, and I don't think I used the word terror in my book. I was trying not to.
I don't recall you
on purpose. I was trying to avoid it because it's such a loaded word. But he did say, I have made them afraid of me. And that was his, that was, from that point on, that was his objective. He had defeated them in battle. In fact, he said, I have defeated you in battle. I will defeat you in battle again if I have to. But then the next stage of the campaign was to make them afraid so that they would never rise up again. And that's when they accelerated the burning of food supplies, the villages. They went up to the mission. And after the Coeur d'Alene Treaty Council, they headed down to Laetai Creek. And that's when the real vindication began with the hangings.
Including the hanging of
Qualchan, yeah.
And tell that story, and how, including how Qualchan was lured into camp.
So they made camp at Smith's Ford on what was known as the Nedwald, or even at that time it was called Laetai Creek by some people. It was a popular crossing point. It had been an Indian trail and a trapper's trail for generations. It's a wide, shallow kind of a canyon or draw, and it was an easy place to water the horses and spread out. So Wright camped there with his force and packers. There were about 1,000 men, about 1,000 animals, and then Indians started coming in and camping, and there were several hundred Indians camped there, so it was a spectacular sight. It must have been really been something. And they were getting along. They were playing, you know, the soldiers were playing with the Indian kids and, you know, all that stuff. And Wright sent out word that he wanted the Spokanes and the Palouse and anybody who had any concerns about peace to come in and he'd talk. And he would treat them respectfully. So he sent out, the Yakima chief Auhai came in to camp to talk peace. And Wright placed him in irons. And Auhai didn't understand it because he had never been a leader in the fighting. What he had done was he had angered Wright in 1856 by standing him up at a council that Wright wanted to have in the Yakima Valley. Auhai Kamayakin and a couple other guys were supposed to meet him, and they decided not to. They blew him off. And that
so
made
when
Wright
puts Auhai in irons, does he know he's Qualchan's father?
He figures it out, and he sent out two messengers with notes to find Qualchan and ask him to come in and talk. And we don't think that the messengers ever found Qualchan. Qualchan's sister later said that no messengers came, but some Spokanes told Qualchan that he could go in and there would be no consequences. But Qualchan didn't know. They didn't know, and Qualchan didn't know that Alhai was there.
It was in the camp.
Yeah. So it was that communication line that was so effective that told Qualchan. So he went down there with his wife and his brother, and some accounts say there was a hunchback with them. I don't know. For some reason, came riding down the canyon, and the soldiers, first-hand accounts of the soldiers say they're standing there, and they're watching these people come in, and they're dressed ceremonially, you know, with socks. His wife is carrying a big spear,
right.
Staff, ceremonial.
Very striking figure.
Very dramatic,
yeah.
I'd love to write about her if there was information. But some accounts say she immediately rode up to Wright's tent and thrust the spear into the ground, and some accounts say she did that after her husband was hanged. And I don't know which is true, but either way, that's good. It's a good
yeah.
visual.
Yeah. Right.
Qualchan came in, according to George Wright, at 9 in the morning. He saw his father in chains. He immediately became angry. Wright had him grabbed by the soldiers and dragged away and hanged.
So, 10 minutes, basically, after coming into camp, he's hanged.
Right.
Which was something that Wright had said, had told someone would happen if Qualchan showed up.
Yeah. There was one of the packers was in a tent with Wright and Dr. Randolph the night before, and Dr. Randolph said, are you gonna capture Qualchan and take him back if he shows up? And he goes, Wright said, hell, capture him. I'm gonna hang him. Yeah.
So that does beg the question of whether, and it, as you report, it came up in considering the case for war crimes in the Philippines. Where the armed forces, the United States Armed Forces, is trying to measure itself and work out what is civilized behavior, even in warfare, for its troops.
Mm-hmm.
And Wright's action is a watermark of something that at least came up to and over the line. They really struggle with this, not just the immediate aftermath of what happened in 1858, but later on in the annals of our history. It is something that we all have to reflect upon and measure our civility, even as a nation that clearly gives itself permission to go to war.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. And there was something about all of those hangings that was particularly gruesome. I think, again, you kind of got to it with your remark about the menace that was underlying all this stuff, is that they didn't really hang people in those days. They strangled them to death. So when they hung somebody, they would put the rope around the neck and throw the end of the rope over a tree branch and just pull them up, and they would strangle, and it would take up to 20 minutes or so for them to actually die. They weren't using a drop. And as Wright continued this march down into the Palouse, he started hanging Palouse people, and he would make their families watch, and he would assemble people to watch. And that's the kind of thing the Nazis did in Eastern Europe. And
so it goes beyond shock and awe bombardment.
Right.
This is a shock and awe of inhumanity, basically.
Yeah.
Of another sort, but pretty much for the same result: to intimidate.
There was a description of one of the dragoons cutting an Indian's head with his saber in the Battle of Four Legs. He cleaved his head in two, and that's gruesome and everything. But I get it, because you're in a battle and the heat and everything. But Wright did so many things that were calculated. That is, to me, more unnerving.
Mm-hmm.
That he actually had time to plan this out, and it wasn't, a defensive thing he was doing, or in a battle he was doing it. To me, that is the really disturbing thing about this.
So, before I leave you, there's one of the other characters here that really interests me, in part because there's an trail I hike behind well, it's in Indian Canyon. It's west of the golf course. There's a makeshift monument to Chief Gary about his story, and it's told. I wish I'd brought it with me, and just how heartbroken he was by his interaction with the whites, and how he, as the history records, you know, really extended himself to protect his people, but also have a conversation, which he hoped would end well, with the white settlers and the white officials. And he's, like Father Joe said, he's all along this trail, trying to absorb it and trying to make something good of it, both in terms of protecting his people and wanting them to have a place in the midst of this campaign, which I can only imagine he in his heart of heart was in some ways terrorized by.
Yeah, he really had a hard time. And there's some really interesting newspaper articles in the Google archives of his life in his older years and his death that I find fascinating about how he lived, what he was living like.
So he winds up being admired by the people who conquered him.
Very much so, yeah.
In his old age and death, he's admired, and yet he dies
destitute.
Yeah. And I don't understand that. I mean, I understand that it happened. But I don't understand the gulf between the admiration and the understanding of his importance and the nobility with which he was trying his best for his people and for peace, to let him not just die destitute, but be ripped off.
Yeah, he was ripped off. Yeah, and he lived comfortably for a while, but was cheated out of his land. And his funeral was paid for out of a fund for the destitute, a county fund
right.
for the destitute.
Spokane County.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that. Why didn't somebody step up to help him? There was one newspaper article talking about a doctor that went out to check on him and helped him, and said, the chief lays in his teepee and can't move very well, and blah, 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 and he's not getting enough food, and the doctor did what he could for him, But they never moved him. Maybe he wouldn't go. I don't know. But I think they would have taken him to a hospital. I mean, there was some pretty compassionate stuff written.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me.
There is something missing.
It's one of the reasons I think this book is such a gift, is the way it brings, it comes to us as a story of events connected. It's not just a card from a deck that arrives and we react to out of context. You really build the context around it, and you know your writing skills give it the floor of a good narrative at the same time. And I just want to return to where we started, which was with your what I think of as your third question, in addition to the two that you say you ask about, who was George Wright, and gosh, did the Indians think he was a hero? And you do a lot of work, and I want to set up your quote here from your prologue correctly. Perceptions of Wright. I mean, you make the choice of actually starting with his tragic drowning when the, I forget the name of the steamship.
Brother Jonathan.
Brother Jonathan sinking is worth the cost of the book alone. It's
There have been books written about that. There are two books written about that sinking.
Really?
Because it carried so much money, and it ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court about who owned the treasure. And the recovery of the treasure is fascinating. There's still millions.
Well, it's an epic, and it includes the and I won't describe it, the macabre remains of of George Wright.
Size 9, I love that.
Yeah, and what's there and what isn't. But I'll let folks read the book for that. But it becomes it becomes a device, a good one for you to say, you know, in many ways, Wright wasn't fulfilled. He really went to the last years of his life feeling he didn't get the opportunities that he deserved. He didn't get the credit he deserved. He didn't get the promotions he deserved. And you know, he writes these long letters about, you know, come on, well, you know, I've done this and that. Didn't get the, he wasn't a Civil War figure like Sheridan and the others. And so he's, yet when he passes, it becomes, it is a national event. He gets obituaries from coast to coast. And at that age, it was to celebrate him as a, and his conquest, and to give it a meaning that increasingly people, to say they're skeptical of it doesn't quite do credit to it. There's more and more we are hearing the voices of anguish from Native Americans who complain, for example, that we've got a college and a street, a campus named after him, and what should we do about that? Should we change it? So it is in that context, as you're evaluating how he passed and how he was regarded by historical societies, even up to the one that placed the monument, that you wrote this. I don't believe Wright was a hero, but I hesitate to condemn him, for to do that would make it easy to separate him from me, from all of us. Close quote. And then you go on to use other information to say that because we are all wired for violence. So I guess where I want to push you on that a little bit is the example that you gave recently about violence in the act of conflict, you know, where people's blood and endorphins are up and they do violence out of anger and self-preservation. But Wright's violence was different. It was qualitatively different, and you make that case well in your book, not as a table-pounding argument, but just as a writer, a historian that's trying to account for what happened.
Yeah, there. You know, social scientists tell us that maybe 5% of the population are sadists, whatever.
Take your pick.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't know who they are until they're put in a certain situation, like killing horses, and you can see them start to take joy in it. Wright never expressed joy in what he did that I'm aware of. In all the letters I read, he was always kind of serious, sometimes dour, often self-pitying. But he was very proud of the fear that he instilled in these people. And I look at what he did, and I like to think, if I had to do that job, if I was sent on that mission, I could see myself doing a lot of things he did, with the exception of conducting those cruel executions the way he did, and the absence of trials. You know, maybe I would have executed people, but I don't know what I would have done. Maybe something would have snapped in me, and I would have thought, well, the way to solve this is to scare as many people as possible, and so I'm going to do something really ugly. If I would have done that, I would hope history would condemn those actions.
Mm-hmm. There is an echo in this. I mean, as I read your book, I was, this year itself will go down as a remarkable year in history because of the, before we even get to the Trump situation, we have to deal with the Millar situation, the takeover of a national wildlife refuge by essentially a self-appointed militia, which has echoes of the militia that was here 158, 160 years ago, creating a narrative, I'll characterize it, in my words, as white supremacy, Anglo supremacy, and we're getting a refrain of that this year in our politics. You know, with well, in so many ways, which I won't enumerate. I mean, we can all read the headlines and the denials. But it seems that this the conquest of Native Americans in North America couldn't have been done without a manifest destiny attitude on the part of Anglo-Saxons, that they were better equipped to not only make better use of the land, but to impose a higher civility and morality upon the world through that conquest.
Yeah.
And this this rich, wonderful book, more than just giving us historical dates and facts, and it gives us that question to wrestle with.
Yeah.
It really does. And I just wanted to, before I give you the last word on that, thank you for it. It really is a gift.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's really,
thank you.
I hope people, when they read it, will have the same experience I did, which is to read two-thirds and reflect a third on what's going on in this story.
Yeah, there is a lot. I felt like there were questions I answered, I mean, asked and didn't answer. Maybe it was because I didn't know, but sometimes I felt like I don't want to tell the reader what to think. If a reader goes through the book and ends up thinking that I'm being too hard on George Wright or too easy on George Wright, that's fine, you know. But I just want them to know that what happened was not just, and regardless of what anybody thinks of Wright or anybody else, just that if those actions ever start to happen again, that we're more aware of it, and hopefully we can stop them.
Yeah, that is, you know, one of the reasons is I love the way you wrote the book for that reason. You wanted to hold the facts up to the light and just let people look and examine them. You weren't begging them towards a conclusion.
Right.
But in that, you know, so to me, like, it's a piece that has a wonderful underlying reflection of your own morality about how to approach it. The other thing, of course, that's here we are, two white guys talking about this chapter in our history, and having to be cognizant that, you know, we're wrestling with our own experience here, and the Native Americans had their own and still wrestle with this in ways that to me are remarkable. And I'll just say that the level of reflection and albeit there is some justifiable anger there, there's a lot of unexpected forgiveness. There's a lot of forgiveness that our Native brothers and sisters have extended us that, in my view, we should all be deeply grateful for.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think that's true. I talked to a number of Native Americans. There's only one individual I picked up any kind of animosity from, and I thought it was really misplaced in this case, but I just was amazed with how gracious and how much we have to learn from the mindset that many of them have, that it just is no good to go back and feel guilt or to beat ourselves up about what our people did that we had no control over. But it there is great value in looking at what happened and then learning from that.
Well, Don, thank you again for all the work that you put into this. And I hope
My pleasure.
I hope you recover from it well so we can read your next book.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.